I wanna fuck.
Welcome back to the Blood and Background Podcast. I'm Ryan from CloseplayStation.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Martin.
How's it going?
Doing pretty well. We are back with a new episode. Took a little break because we couldn't stomach Evil Dead Rise, so we had to, you know, take a little bit of time off from that one.
Apparently we were the only ones.
No, you know what? I've seen some more people now come out and say, because I kind of made a joke about it. I made a joke on TikTok where I pretended like I didn't understand Evil Dead Rise, but then I referred to it as Renfield, and some people were like saying, yeah, but no, seriously, I thought Evil Dead Rise was not that good, and I was like, yeah, same here. And then I did see another person, you know, that another horror fan that I talked to online, and he voiced pretty much the same criticism that we did. Take away the Evil Dead Rise name, you're left with any old exorcism movie
I was kind of shocked when I saw like Red Letter Media's review of it, and they thought it was pretty good, and they thought the gore was, you know, it's one of the goriest films they've seen in a while. I'm like, I mean, it's gory, but I mean, I wouldn't say like at this point, it's not like you're gonna be like, oh my god,
right? No,
you know, this is captivating,
right? Yeah, no, I agree, and I think that like I understand why people like it to some extent, because like I said in the show. I thought it was fine. It was fine as a movie, but it definitely did not meet the standards of an Evil Dead film. And I get it, but at the same time, I just don't think it was that good. And I haven't changed my opinion either since the show. Like, I've actually, for one thing, I haven't really thought about the movie again. So that's one bad thing about the movie, is that I just really haven't thought about it. It hasn't really come out. And I haven't really changed my opinion. I think it's still exactly where it was when we talked about it 2 weeks ago. So stick by my review of that movie. But today we got a different, or completely change up from what we've been talking about, Evil Dead Rise. We're hearkening back to, it's a nostalgia factor, right? It's, we're heading back to the late 90s, early 2000s, thinking about, you know, like, let's frame it like this. Shows like Charmed and Angel are on the air. There's still a WB, I think.
There's still a UPN, yeah.
No, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. They still exist.
Dawson's Creek is on, like, season 3 now.
You've got, you still got an ABC Family, I believe. Or no, I'm sorry, a Fox Family. Fox Family channel. A prominent part of the radio airwaves is, you know, what we consider now like adult contemporary. Has a good time. It was a good time in the 90s. We're heading back there. And just to give you a heads up of you can see it in the title, obviously, but pretend like you didn't see the title itself. You didn't see all of the show information when you queued up this episode. We've got a few different big names from the time. We've got Ryan Philippe, for one. We've got Joshua Jackson here. Joshua Jackson, in the 90s and 2000s, just seems to show up in things. It's just like no one invited him, and somehow he's just on set, and people are like, all right, I mean, I guess we got a part for you. Come on in, Joshua Jackson.
What are you doing here? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He just got to...
I was Charlie Conway in The Mighty Ducks.
For some reason, you know, I don't know if it's because, like, they were filming Dawson's Creek on the same set, and he's just around, and they're like, Joshua, we got something for you over here. And he was just like, all right, fine. But like he shows up, you know, Urban Legend. He's in this movie. Like he just seemed to show up in the 90s.
Scream 2. He was in Scream 2.
Yeah, you're right. Scream 2.
Just film class guy number one.
And not only that, our other main big name for this movie, Sarah Michelle Gellar, was also in Scream 2.
And also in I Know What You Did Last Summer, which rightfully was also.
Yeah, they were just,
I mean, just
pounding around out there.
It's just the connections here are just.
Are they connections, or is it just because we were talking about the big names of the time?
I think they're just people, the Weinstein brothers were keeping an eye on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. But not only that, we got Selma Blair. Not as big of a name in the 90s, but still. Selma Blair's here.
She's kind of like, well, never mind. I was going to say, she's like a low-rent Parker Posey.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
No offense to Selma.
And then we've got, should mention, Tara Reid shows up. Just a very bit part, but she's here. So again, you know you're in a 90s, 2000s movie. And then you've got, what else we got here? There's one other person that I wanted to mention, but now I'm drawing a blank. Oh, of course, Reese Witherspoon.
Reese, what are you doing here?
I don't know. Maybe I forgot who I was trying to say because she's so vanilla. But spicy, too, in this movie. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. So what movie are we talking about, Martin?
American Beauty.
Yeah. American Beauty. No. We're talking about a movie that somehow aired on TV quite a bit. How did that happen?
I owned it on VHS, so that's how.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that in the previous episode. Yeah. You mentioned that you wore your copy out, rewinding it to the same spots. Someone says, hey, let's pop this in and watch it. And they're like, wait, why 20 minutes in does this stop working?
You know how as a kid, you're playing like a video game before you go to school, and you're like as far as like you've ever been, you're like, oh, shit. And you hit pause, and you turn the TV off, and you pray to God when you get back.
That's still going to be there. Yep.
That might have been me with some of the Sarah Michelle Gellar kids.
Yeah. Of course. No, we're talking about Cruel Intentions, of course. The 1999 movie from a guy that probably no one really knows that much about for direction. Roger Cumble. I think he's pretty much just well known for Cruel Intentions. He did a couple of rom-coms of the time. He did The Sweetest Thing. He did Just Friends in 2005, that Ryan Reynolds one where he plays a fat guy and then gets, like, skinny. But I think for the most part, he's just well known for Cruel Intentions. And then he did a sequel to Cruel Intentions. And this is, like we said, this film is a huge nostalgia trip. Especially for me, Sarah Michelle Gellar was a huge Buffy fan. I was a huge Sarah Michelle Gellar fan. I had seen this movie, and I don't think I actually had seen like the entirety of this movie all at once. I had seen bits and pieces of it and pretty much the whole movie, but just in parts. And it was fun to revisit this one and actually sit down and watch it in full. And pick out some of the things that really stand out from a late 1990s movie, because this one has pretty much it all, which we'll talk about, all of the tropes. But not only that, this film is basically like a fucking soap opera to a certain extent. It is a very soapy, pulpy, sexually charged movie. And let's see, was it 1999? I would have been, what, like 10 years old? Yeah, that would have been my thing here. Just coming into puberty, seeing some of my favorite women on screen, and some raunchy exposition.
Right next to your Britney Spears binder.
Yeah, not too far off there. I did have a Britney Spears like collectible bear. It's like a Thai Beanie Baby bear, but a Britney Spears one that I left in the box because I thought it was going to be collectible and worth a lot. And then I ended up selling it in a garage sale for like $2, maybe.
Let's say, but you did have, I think, what was it? Britney Spears poster.
Yep, I did by my bed.
Yeah, her first album. Yeah.
Yep.
Oops, you did it again.
I did. So for you, you said you own this on VHS.
I didn't.
Oh, you're just lying.
The family did.
Oh yeah, family did. Oh, so who's go ahead.
As I say, I don't know why.
Okay.
Bought it, but I mean, we had it.
That's what I was gonna ask. Who's you know, who was the one that was really like, we've got to go out and get this on VHS?
It's probably my mom probably bought it and was like, no, this looks like a movie. There's one time she accidentally rented us White Men Can't Jump. And now when she saw like Woody Harrelson and like in the shower, the boobs. And she's like, all right, it's gonna fucking go. Like, wrong movie. So that was like 94. But I mean, so, you know, it's not like there's a lot of screening going on in the media that was being in talk. It was just probably like, oh, yep.
Huh. So she just saw it, picked it up.
Somebody did. I don't know. And it was the same thing, too. Like in 2000, you know, when American Pie, well, 99, well, American Pie comes out. We had a copy of American Pie. I don't know who was asking for a copy of American Pie. I would have been 10. My younger sister would have been 9. Kate, my older sister would have been, you know, 13. And then, no, yeah. And my parents didn't really watch movies, so I don't know. There's just a lot of films like that randomly would just end up, and maybe I have some questions to ask my mom about that. But hey, like, why were you buying Road Trip with Tom Green in 2002? Were you like, that Breckin Meyer sure has a beautiful smile? You know?
Yeah. So, but other than that, you've watched it quite a bit.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So we'll talk about how it holds up over time. I don't want to know what 10 or 11 year old Martin was doing in his room with the VHS.
No, I never did that. I was watching in the living room.
All right. Yeah. All right. So let's take a break. I hear you cracking a cold one. Yeah, cold one over there. Let's take a break, talk about the beer that we have on the show today. Why don't you start us off?
So today, to keep up with the bouginess of what we're going to be talking about today, film-wise, we have a beer from, Massachusetts' own Treehouse, which we've done a couple of their beers on the show. One of our friends was going out to Treehouse, one of their locations, and asked if we wanted anything. We said, hell yeah. And so we all got a bunch of different beers, but one of the beers I got, because they make such delightful IPAs, and to kind of keep in theme with bougie downstate douchebags from downstate New York, you know, Long Islanders, they have an IPA called the Brewmosa. And what's more douchey and bougie than drinking a mimosa? Which I can say I've only had once in my life, which is at your after wedding party. So yeah.
What do you think about a mimosa? How do you feel? Yeah.
I'm not a big champagne fan, so.
I like mimosas, to be honest with you.
I mean, maybe I was feel differently now, but it's like you said, like, I don't like champagne. Like, it's like when we do like the champagne style beers, like that, like, whoa, sparkling, like tickly, you know, that it's not what I'm drinking for, so it doesn't really, you know, do anything for me.
Well, there's a reason Jessica gets tipsy at brunch, and that's because of the mimosa, because they are dangerously alcoholic for you, because you're doing half champagne, half orange juice. The orange juice makes the bubbly go down real smooth, and before you know it, you're keeling over into the eggs. They just go down that fast.
Wait, hold on. Are they scrambled?
For me, yes, they are.
Then you're wrong.
Scrambled with some hot sauce on top can't go wrong.
You do sunny side up so you can dunk your rye toast in that yolk and have...
See, I don't really like the runny yolk. This is a... We have our food podcast. We'll record that one after this. We'll talk about the merits of different types of eggs. But no, I don't really like runny yolk, to be honest with you. Kind of grosses me out, but to each their own.
Euro.
No, but the Brumosa is meant to be basically a beer version of the Mimosa. And I think that it does a pretty good job of getting that down. I would like to read some of the can for you because I think it's a great lead in for this beer. They say, "Nary there be a morning that isn't improved with a romp in the sunshine with friends and a liquid treat to keep the Sunday scaries at bay." And they go on to say, "We taste fresh pressed orange juice and zippy tangerine peel swirled among mango syrup and citrusy hops. Dust off the champagne flutes, because this beer and those you share it with are worth celebrating right now." So they really give, you know, a nice rundown of what you can expect from the Brumosa. And I think, too, for the most part, they are right on. This is, you know, first and foremost, an IPA. So you'll notice that sometimes with fruited IPAs, they kind of actually cut down on some of the hoppiness of it. With the Brumosa, that doesn't happen. You can still tell that this is an IPA, and it's actually a triple IPA, I believe. This is a 9% beer. I think it's technically a triple, and it does have the hoppiness that is very present throughout, but you also get a very, very prominent orange and, to some extent, tangerine taste to it. For me, I don't really get a lot of the mango that they're saying is in here. But ultimately, I think it's really, really tasty. It goes down smooth even at 9%. And at first, I thought I was detecting like a little bit of over-bitterness to it. But now that I've been having a little bit more, that's not coming out as prominently. I think this is really, really smooth. And I've had a few different types of orange tangerine IPAs, and they are hit or miss because sometimes there's too much orange. Sometimes the bitterness of the orange rind can overpower because you're putting bitter hops in there along with the rind, or sometimes the rosininess of it can be extra spicy with the orange. So in the acidity, you really run the risk of having an overly acidic beer here, but the Brumosa doesn't have that. I think it's a really solid beer, one that I would recommend.
Yeah, I think it's really good. I don't think it's really standout though. It definitely has, I don't really, as you said, I don't really get any mango. Mainly just get, you know, straight orange, orange rind, orange zest. You know, I think if they wanted to, like, kind of, like, give it a little bit more oomph instead of, like, tangerine, maybe do a blood orange. That way, you know, get a little bit more of that bitterness. It is slightly rosiny, but not too bad. If you don't like that, I do. It's really smooth, really easy drinking. I don't really notice like a, you know, champagne quality to it to make it feel like a mimosa. It's just kind of like a bog standard orange nuts, you know.
Yeah, that's
citrusy NIPA.
Yep.
Which isn't bad. Like I said, I think this is a really good job. But to be honest with you, like in, you know, the whole mimosa thing, well, don't really feel it, because I think if you really wanted to do that, you'd have to kind of do like a champagne, like IPA, and use something to get, like, I imagine that'd be kind of hard to do because it's such a, you know, weird style, and then mix that with like an orange NIPA. But I think with that being said, though, it is really good, but it's not anything I think in I would ever really run out to buy again, because I think out of everything we got, this was one of the most expensive four packs. It was like $23 for a four pack. And it's really good, but I don't think to the name of what it's supposed to be, it kind of lives up to it. It's a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah,
but like I said, if you do like, you know, citrusy style NIPAs, then it's going to be really good, and you're going to enjoy it. And for a triple, it's really easy. You know, you get, you know, you don't get any alcohol. So,
yeah, that's, I think you bring up a good point that as a mimosa style, you would expect maybe to have like more dryness to it, right? Like more of the champagne-y dryness that you would get from that champagne IPA, and you don't get that from this one. So that is an interesting, you know, observation of this beer, that you might expect more dryness from it. It doesn't have that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's good. Like you said, not super standout, but I think they do a pretty good job with this one. And Treehouse always makes, you know, I've never really had a bad Treehouse beer. So you can't really go wrong with any of their selection, but I think they have better IPAs than this one, but it's still really good. All right, so Cruel Intentions. Where do we start with Cruel Intentions?
What's a cruel intentions?
This movie, I think, is epitomizes the late 90s, early 2000s movie. It kind of has everything going for it there. From the soundtrack to the stars to the dress to the lighting, it's kind of all there. And not only that, but if you grew up in the 90s, you probably, to some extent, know Cruel Intentions. Like, I can't imagine.
Not another teen movie. One of the biggest things they parody, besides She's All That, which we've done, is Cruel Intentions.
Yeah, I feel like you had to have been really living under a rock to just not know about the movie for some reason. It was just a big thing at the time. I don't know why, but it was. And I guess, like, one of the draws of this movie was that it did take some stars who really weren't known for their maturity and raunchiness, and it kind of put them into a much like a, almost like an erotic thriller. So Sarah Michelle Gellar, for instance, you know, most notable for playing Buffy at this time, all of a sudden she's really shifting her character in acting ability in Cruel Intentions to be a completely different person. You know, so Buffy's always like very peppy and bubbly and you know, I'm the
smart alky, quippy one-liners.
Yeah. And then you go to Cruel Intentions and
she's got quippy one-liners.
She does have quippy one-liners. But Catherine here is just a much different person than Buffy, and it requires her to really pull from a different acting oeuvre, you know. here, like, this is something that we didn't really see from Sarah Michelle Gellar, and I think for some people, myself included, they were titillated.
Look at that poster.
Exactly. I mean, the titillations is right there. It's preparing you for what's to come in the movie. So yeah, I mean, this is a hypersexualized movie to some extent. The plot itself basically revolves around sex to a certain point. You know, the setup for this is really like, I mean, the title kind of gives it away. What are they doing? They have cruel intentions. They're stepsister and stepbrother with a really strange relationship with each other, just never really fleshed out to much extent, but besides the fact that, like, they live in this ridiculous penthouse suite sort of thing. They go to a prep school. They are just fucking grossly rich. And they have pretty much, you know, become the worst people that you can possibly think of. Just horrible, horrible, despicable people. And their main function in life is to basically break people down and try to, you know, just get them to their worst point. And would you agree? I mean, that's basically the plot of Cruel Intentions, just summing it up. And then all, you know, along with that, they like to get laid a lot. They like to have sex. And the whole idea is breaking people while trying to have sex with them.
You have a sociopath.
Yeah, these people don't murder so much as they just...
They're still sociopaths.
Yeah.
So they don't have any fixation, you know, any worldview outside of, like, what, you know, pleases and, you know, excites them.
They're...
And the fact that, especially Ryan Phillippe in this, is, you know, a serial assaulter, sexual assaulter.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like the biggest thing, like, kind of, like, coming back to this now is, like, man, I don't, like, there's a lot of things in this film that did not age well. He's not, like, oh, look at him. He's not that cute. It's more like, wow. Groomers take notes.
Right. Yeah, I do think that that's, like, with Cruel Intentions, you know, you're obviously, these are anti-heroes. They're not really people that you, as the viewer, are supposed to, like, follow and be like, oh, well, they probably mean well at heart, right? Like, you actually are supposed to actively dislike them. Although, one would argue that Sebastian, as a character, is the one that you're supposed to
sympathize
with the most, because not only does Ryan Phillippe have a cute face, right? He's got a nice cute face. You see his little nice little tight tush in here, too. So, if you weren't...
At those nice blonde curls.
Yep. If you weren't already sympathizing with him after, you know, seeing him and his face, then when you get that shower scene when he's, pool scene when he's changing, and you see his nice little tight little tush, you're like, oh, okay, I can kind of understand where he's coming from now. He's just a nice little guy. Look at him. Yeah, he's just so cute. But, like, you are supposed to sympathize with them to a certain extent. And I think that's kind of one of the problematic things about Cruel Intentions. Obviously, it is, you're supposed to sympathize with them towards the end, because the movie is all about him having a full-on character realization, like, holy shit, I'm a fucking shitbag person. And why do I do these things? I don't know. And I want to change myself, right? And... you know, so you are supposed to sympathize with him to that extent, but it's really hard after you've seen the movie and you're like, yeah, okay, I guess, like, you want to be a better person, but you did some really horrible things, like, throughout the movie. It's kind of hard to put yourself in that situation where at the end of the movie you forgive Sebastian.
Because at the same time, it also doesn't work, because, like, if that's the route you're going for, you can't at the end of the film scold and be like, what a piece of shit Catherine is.
Mm-hmm.
What a horrible human being. Because at the end of the day, for the, like, you know, that to be kind of like, you know, her to be found out to be this manipulative person, like, and everyone's like, you know, at the end, the whole school finds out after, you know, Sebastian died, you know, that, like, what a horrible human being she is. It's like, yeah. Help her. Sebastian's horrible too. Like, you know, just because he put a burn book at the end doesn't mean, like, he's exonerated. Like, oh, listen, you know, you were with Selma Blair and you told her, like, I want to kiss you, but I didn't mean I was talking about your lips. I mean, I want to eat your pussy, you know. And she's like, oh, okay, I can tell him, you know, that you're like, what a great guy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he found the light at the end.
I kind of find it funny that, like, yeah, you're right, like, the burn book and everything at the end is supposed to sort of exonerate his character, Sebastian. It's like, well, you know what, he owned up to it. He showed Reese Witherspoon's character in that this burn book, and he kind of, you know, even though it made him look bad, and even though you kind of are probably questioning him a little bit now because he has a fucking bullet journal. Keeps a bullet journal, like, literally every single day.
He's fucking Arthur Morgan pulling it out right there.
literally, like, pre-live journal sort of fucking writing in the margins of a marble notebook.
I'm going to say, he saw Doug, and he's like, dear diary, the best part about that journal is, too, is the fact that when, like, because he's constantly writing through it, Sarah Michelle Gellar is always like, what are you, gay?
Yeah. Journaling is gay. But like this, that whole idea of sharing the notebook with Annette and expecting her to just be like, okay, you guys made a bet that you were going to take my virginity because you thought you could corrupt me. She's like, I forgive now. It doesn't really make sense. And I don't get the feeling in this movie. I never got the feeling like we ever see an actual change in Sebastian. He's just sort of like goes from being the sociopath to being maybe a little bit less of a sociopath. And he just also likes Annette. There's not even like later on in the movie where we're supposed to get this feeling like he's changed. There's that whole scene where he's still having sex with Selma Blair's character, Cecile, and he's just like practicing with, she's supposed to be practicing with him. And there's that where she's like kind of on top of him and saying like, oh, what are you doing writing in your journal? And he like literally throws her off the fucking, yeets her right off the fucking bed.
I shouldn't say he is a thrower. He literally yeets her right off the fucking bed. Like,
And then
out of here, woman.
Yeah. And at that,
this is called reflection time.
At that moment, you're like, he has changed, hasn't he? He's such a much better guy now.
He was, you know what? When he was fucking her that time, he was doing it doggy because he didn't want to look her dead in the eyes or reverse cowgirl so she wasn't looking him in the eyes. Like, no, my love's for Reese. Reese Witherspoon, this makes it okay.
I get a really hinky feeling about Selma Blair's character in this show, in this movie too, Cecile, because as you said, he is really like a groomer. They are kind of grooming her. She is supposed to be on the younger side because she's inexperienced and she's obviously immature.
She's supposed to be like a freshman in this.
I know. It's very
because they're like the whole film, like this is where like the whole 90s, especially in the 90s when it comes to like teen dramas, hasn't aged well at all, because everyone in this film that goes to the school outside the extras at the end at the school are like 30 fucking years old. So it's like when you're watching this film as Sarah Michelle Gellar snorting coke and wearing these, you know, corsets and they're having sex and they're drinking, it's, and you're seeing these people living their life, and it's like fitting this into high school doesn't they, you know, say it's like at the school. But they, you would think like maybe they mean they're going to like university, but that's not the case because they talk about how like other people they know are getting ready to go to like different colleges, like Princeton and such. So they're still in high school. So it's like, what fucking high school is this? Like, I mean, I know it's ritzy and bougie and, you know, blue blood, but I mean, they all look like they're 30 fucking years old at this point. Like, yeah, like it's just like doesn't work in that sense. And now that you said it too, that like, you know, Selma Blair, she's new, come to school, and Sebastian and them, because it's a new year in school for him and Catherine, it's basically like they're like their senior year or something. So that means she's like a freshman or something coming to this school. So she's supposed to be like 15 years old.
Yeah, it gives you really like really weird. Honestly, her character gives me very anime vibes, because you have like that innocent school girl persona, and then you have all the panty shots that she does, and at one point she does like a cartwheel and her fucking skirt is hanging out like with the her cello instructor.
It's
just like
head on her fucking head with her legs split and it's muffed right in front of him, like, how can you?
Basically, you see, like, it's like that Looney Tunes dog with the tongue rolling off onto the floor. That's like that's what he's doing at the time. It's like, dude, she's like 15 years old in this. It's and that's the thing too with Cruel Intentions. It actually keeps ages of the character somewhat, you know, opaque. You don't really know exactly how old everyone is, and they don't really say. And you would be forgiven for thinking Sarah Michelle Gellar is like 36 years old, and you know, especially with her, you know, dark haircut or her,
is it say that nice heroin chic she's got going on?
Yeah, because you kind of get that feeling, but it's a little off-putting now to see sort of that thing happening and the grooming that's going on. So it's a weird scenario. What do you think about the storylines, though? Because we actually have two. So the whole idea is that Catherine, Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, and Sebastian, Ryan Phillippe's character, they're step siblings. They have this, like, will they, won't they? They both want to maybe fuck each other, which is in itself strange.
Sarah Michelle Gellar in this is
alluring. So, you know, they set a bet, and basically the bet is corrupt Reese Witherspoon's character, Annette, because she wrote, like, this whole column for a newspaper.
In 17. It is 17.
Oh, sorry, yes, 17 magazine. And she said basically that she's virginal and you should save yourself for marriage or when you actually love somebody, when you know that you love somebody, and you can't know that you love somebody when you're that young. The idea is that they set this bet. Ryan Phillippe's going to corrupt her. But then at the same time, there's another thing going on where Sarah Michelle Gellar's character wants to corrupt Selma Blair's character and make her into this, like, slut because she's trying to get back at her old boyfriend, Court, who's been seeing her. So there's a lot of, like, stuff going on.
Well, you're forgetting the best part of that bet. What's the bet?
The bet is, well, the main part of the bet, let's say that, is that Sarah Michelle Gellar gets the car, the Jaguar, if she wins the bet, and Ryan Phillippe is unable to corrupt Annette. The other side of the bet, the less important side, of course, is that if Ryan Phillippe wins, he gets to have Catherine all to himself, because this is the one woman that he's never been able to conquer, basically. And she says, the thing that makes him take the bet, she says, you can have any hole you want.
Which is the best part, because originally he's like, no, that car is worth a lot. And then, because she, at first she says, you could fuck me.
Yeah.
You could, because I'm the only one you haven't been able to fuck.
And, that's not enough. That's.
And then he's like, no, the car is, you know, it's pricey. She's like, you could have any hole. And he's like,
I think she actually says, I don't think she says any hole. I think you're thinking more along the new porn lines, the new storylines. I think she says, you can stick it anywhere.
Yeah, with same thing. That's the same thing. So sure.
She put it a little daintier.
Not really. She put it daintier, but the way she says the bet is like, you can fuck me. It's not like she's like,
no, I agree. She's a very sultry woman. She has a way with words. You're right.
It's the cocaine.
Yeah, she says you can stick it anywhere. And, you know, for Ryan Phillippe, but especially at that time, you know, he's had a lot of women. Like, the show is right in the opening scene, but he's leaving and they're in, like, a mall courtyard, and a woman comes up to him and he's just like, we're going out after
he makes Tara Reid an internet slob, and her mom's freaking out, and then this random girl's just by like, wow, she's freaking out, and he's like, yeah, she should go see a therapist. That's funny. I'm taking you out for lunch. Okay. And they hold hands and walk. He could be a serial, like, who's doing that now? Like, if a stranger came up to you and was like, I'm taking you out for lunch, you're probably getting pepper sprayed. Like,
well, it just goes to show you how charming he can be.
He's not charming. He's one note and, like, it's very robotic.
Yeah, it's just funny because you know, Sebastian's had a lot of women, but he hasn't been offered the brown hole. That one's been off limits.
Well, how do you know it's that hole? Maybe it's her ears.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is. Maybe he's looking for what do they call that? Frottage or whatever. Where it's just like rubbing up against your elbow or
thigh gap.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah Michelle Gellar is from the head of thigh gap.
Yeah, I mean the bet, like, it has some caveats to it, right? Because, like, they're focused on both of these things. The bet really doesn't have anything to do with Cecile and Selma Blair. That's kind of just pushed in here at times. But, like, they're all kind of working towards the same goal, which is corrupt these two women. And Reese is kind of hard to corrupt, right? She's kind of stubborn in her ways, and Ryan Phillippe has to go through the motions of trying to.
She's not really that hard. It takes 3 days.
Well, you're true. That's true. And not only that, but I think the funniest thing about getting to Annette is that she knows exactly about Sebastian. She knows everything about him. She's been warned. She has a letter that somebody wrote about him. It's like, he's a fucking scumbag.
I think would have been a better twist if it wasn't, you know, Selma Blair's, you know, mother.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was fucking Sarah Michelle Gellar rigging the game.
I thought that would be, it's been a while since I've seen that. So I forgot who it was, and I was like, oh, maybe it's Sarah Michelle Gellar. But yeah, you're right.
That would have made it more interesting.
It would have.
Maybe give him red herrings on, like, his little search, and that way, throughout, when, like, he's, like, thinks he's found it, he can be like, hey, you fucking idiot, it was me the whole time, you know?
Right. I agree. I think that would have been better. But the thing with Annette, too, is, like you said, she knows everything about Sebastian, and yet she still, like, is strangely entranced with him. She attends this, like, it's not even smooth either. He plays like fucking music in her room only to conjure her to the pool. And then, you know, plays, what does he play?
He's playing Ode to Joy.
He's playing that. But then what does he put on? A 90s staple.
No, she does. She like walked by and like flicked the radio to like switch to like.
Does she do it? I thought he did it with the.
I don't know, maybe I'm mistaken, but he had, like, Ode to Joy on.
Oh, that's, yeah, they play Love Fool. Love me, love yeah. Save me, that old chestnut. they put that on, and I was like, I was instantly taken back to, like...
1997.
Yeah.
You can hear the High Rollers playlist now.
Absolutely. yeah, and so she's like, and she, you know, it's like, Reese, use a little bit of precaution here. You know about this guy. You know how scummy he can be. Why are you even giving him the time of day? Like, she's, I don't know. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, especially because you'd also think lots of other people would be warning her. They'd be like, yeah, no, he's done this to me. Even Selma Blair is like, you know, around Annette. She doesn't warn her at all. But anyway, I don't know. The plot is kind of a mess. It really doesn't, you know, add up, and you're not really, I don't know. It's hard to suspend disbelief now and then, but at the same time, we do get a nice romantic love story between the two of them. And who could, you know, in this movie, who can resist the siren song of Reese Witherspoon's stacked sweaters? I mean, she's really got it going on here in this movie, I think. So this movie, though, what do you think about the romance that blossoms between them? Because you get this one point where Sebastian is like, they're making out, they're in a florid affair, and Sebastian's like, I can't, because he knows this has been predicated on a lie. And he leaves. And then Annette's going to go back to Kentucky, wherever she's from. She's Kansas. And she's in the airport, and you get this, oh, it's so 90s.
Substation.
Sorry, substation.
She's going to Penn State. God, did you even watch the movie?
No, I did. I am getting it confused because there's so many romantic 90s movies of capturing her at the airport. In this case, you're right. They're not above ground, they're underground. But at the same time, he shows up, he's on the top of the escalators, standing there waiting for her. What do you think about that?
It's pretty creepy.
He sought her out, stalked her, found her at the substation.
No one said playing like uplifting music like love will last. It should be every breath you take.
Yeah. No, they play Counting Crows, Colorblind.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But I mean, which, wow, what a fucking Counting Crows banger that is.
I really like that song, actually.
No, I do, too. I'm just saying, out of, like, all the songs people are going to list from the Counting Crows, it's going to be Mr. Jones, Accidentally in Love, and Long December, probably, and then everyone's going to fall off. But, no, I mean, the romance is shitty. Because I think the fact that this isn't, like, a whole summer long, like, if you give them, like, 2 months, like, summer break to actually, you know, extend that out to be a bit more believable, because again, they're teens, so, you know, whirlwind romance is a thing. But the fact that it's like literally over 3 days and Ryan Phillippe literally does nothing to be charming and to win her heart over, she's kind of just basically written to be like, no, I like you. It's okay.
It really doesn't. Yeah, you're right.
You know, like, you know,
anything.
Like, he does nothing. Nothing. Like, literally, like, the one thing he does is after they go to, like, do charity at the old folks' home. And she's like, what'd you think about it? And he's like, oh, I love helping old people. And she's like, what'd you really think about it? And he's like, fine, I fucking hate it. And she's like, see, it's okay. He's like, no, I'm a bad person. And she's like, no, that doesn't make you bad. And then she started making silly faces at him.
And that's where he fell in love. He's like, she made me laugh.
Like, no.
It's silly. You're right.
It's so fucking stupid. It's like, it's dumb. It's dumb, 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 dumb. It's so fucking dumb. Because at the end of the day, that character development that we're supposed to feel for him is terrible. Terribly written, terribly played out. But I think Catherine's character development is great because she is this sociopathic person. And when the bet plays out and then she's ready to be fucked by Rhett, because she wants to be fucked, you know, she wants that, you know, to happen.
Well, I'm not sure that she really does. I think to a certain extent she does. She might not mind. But I also think that she just likes to mess with him and...
No, she does, but this is where I'm saying. I think she does, but at the same time, when he rejects her because he's in love, you get to see her, like...
That's the worst part of it, yeah.
The fact that she is being rejected, which she's never been, and, like, her working through that and then seeing her, you know, what she's doing, you know, then she goes to sleep with Ronald. You know, Selma Blair's love interest for no reason, just other than I wanted to get my rocks off. And then afterwards, when he comes back after she manipulates Ryan Phillippe to tell her that he didn't really love her, it was all a game, you know. And he comes back and she's like, I don't fuck losers, so that bet don't mean shit to me. You know, that's great. Like, you know, because she didn't do that just to manipulate. I think the whole reason she did that is because she got rejected. And so, like, it adds that, like, dynamic and development for her. And that works really well, you know, I think, on that end. So, I think, you know,
yeah,
it's not really character growth. I mean, like, the development overall for her is good. I think Ryan Phillippe's a shit that's, like, really trite and...
I know what you're saying because, you know, with Catherine, that is actually, it seems very, fairly realistic. There is nothing that's going to change Catherine unless she gets her comeuppance. Like, there's nothing... Like, no matter what happens to her, she's always going to be this, like, very conceited and manipulative person because that's just who she is. And the only, like, there's no character growth that she's going to have. That's something like what Sebastian has, where it's just like she meets a person and she's totally changed for no reason other than the fact that she just meets this person. It's not realistic, and I think that this movie kind of... It tries to do that with Sebastian, and it wants to have this nice feel-good ending of, like, people can change. I mean, it even has the Verve's bittersweet symphony playing at the end while Reese drives off into the sunset with the Jaguar, and it's playing, I can change, I can change, I can change. Okay. Well, we didn't really see that happen with Sebastian. I don't believe it. And I believe more so the realism of Catherine's character, that she didn't change. And actually, the only thing that they could do is bring her down a notch to see, like, what she's been doing to other people.
And she's not even going to get help. They're going to throw her away.
I love the ending where they have the crucifix. They know that there's cocaine in it, and they come and they look into it. And the guy just does this, you know, the perfect dad. I'm disappointed.
Yeah.
He just like, shake of his head with a little grin. I'm so disappointed.
Put her in jail.
Yeah. She's a drug user. Put her in jail.
Can't be saved. Mm-hmm.
No, I do love that. But I think that this movie may have had a more realistic bent if at the end we find out Sebastian never actually really did change. It was all still a ploy with Annette. And at the end, they both get their comeuppance in some way. And it has more of a downbeat ending, whereas like they didn't change and they're fucking sociopaths. And what are you going to do about that? The only thing you can do is leave them to their own devices where they ruin each other. And I think that that would have been like a better way for Cruel Intentions to play that out, because it would have shown, again, like, yes, it would have been a really downer ending, but it would have shown that like the redemption quality here is not just about like meeting someone and becoming a different person because like you met them. The redemption quality is you ruined yourself and you deal with the consequences of that. Like I said to you, I think this movie could have had a smarter theme about why hurt people, right? Like, but there's no care. We don't get any characterization about why Catherine and Sebastian are the way they are. They play off of each other, sure.
I think that's more because, especially, I mean, I haven't done a lot of research, but being based off, you know, the French, you know, novel that came out, like, you know, leading up to the French Revolution, they're bougie for the sake of being bougie, and they're deplorable because they are rich, out-of-touch fucks. They're blue bloods that don't, you know, have a connection, you know, connection. They're, everything's kind of, because of their wealth, they get to kind of just, you know, see the world as their playground.
Yeah, but I would argue that doesn't come out that well in this movie either.
No, it doesn't, but I think the setting alone and the constant fact that we're bombarded by, you know, everyone is high class. Hell, you even have Selma Blair's mom when she finds out about her tryst with her cello teacher, Ronald, like, when he's like, oh, is this because I'm black? And she's like, I donated to Colin Powell, thank you very much. Don't give me the race card. We picked you off the street. And he's like, I go to Juilliard, and I'm, you know, from, like, a well-to-do family. Yeah. She's like, get out of here, you know? So it's, it is there. I'm not saying it's, like, incredibly explored, but it's there. Like, you know, the whole setting of this film is just, you know, downstate Long Island debauchery. You know, when we see Annette at the first time at Sebastian's family place, they're fucking riding horses and he's, you know, skeet shooting and they're wearing their polo shirts and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that alone kind of is supposed to be why, you know, the stand-in for why are they such ungrateful pieces of shit? Because they're just rich pieces of shit.
True. I mean, I guess rich pieces of shit is enough of a characterization. I just wish that we had seen a little bit more.
That's the sequel. You got to see the sequel.
I guess so.
Probably why they became piece of shit.
What did you think of the music in this movie? Because it is ever present.
But as you said when we were texting, it's like they took like the end, like Enya music, and just threw it randomly out.
I do. It's so burdensome sometimes. It's just there in the background doing zany things, and you're just like, I think it's actually more something you focus on more in some of the dialogue scenes than the actual dialogue, and it's kind of a bad thing to have. Is you don't want the music to be so prominent that the viewer is focusing on that instead, because you know it just has so much of like a, I don't know, like a peppiness to it, but it has like that electronic-y, I don't even know how to describe it, right? Like, it's like Prodigy synth-like, I don't know. It's just, it's not my favorite in this movie. And while I do enjoy the deep cuts from the 90s, I think that they probably should have excised some of the background music, because it's just, it's a little overpowering.
It's literally that commercial with like the Enya, like the Enya, like CDs from Time Life, like, listen to Gregorian.
I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's a little much sometimes. You know what? Actually, we didn't talk about this. Film is kind of interesting in how it portrays gay people.
Kind of interesting, you say.
Yeah. it makes a lot of derogatory remarks about that.
You mean homophobic.
Yeah. But then again, you have Joshua Jackson's character who is gay. And there's that one scene where Ryan Phillippe says something like, he's like a fag. And then he's like, but no offense. And he's like, none taken?
Because his friend's gay.
Yeah.
It's that middle ground.
I know
saying that's wrong.
How do you feel about that? How do you feel about how the film treats gay people?
I mean, it's not great.
It's not great. It's quite a few references.
Not what you want to see in today, but I mean, it's kind of front loaded, so they get it out of the way in like the first 20 minutes.
Yeah.
No, I mean, because it's not good. It's just as problematic as like the sexual assault. But the fact that like, because it's the 90s with like, especially with like the closet and aspect of it.
Yeah.
It does still kind of work because of the fact that it's the 90s and what, you know, Joshua Jackson's character is like a, you know, supposed to be like manly football player, because he's like, it's the giant, you know, it's the Greg Steer, you know, doing the whole Rob Schneider bit from SNL.
Oh, that's that's Eric Mabius, not Joshua Jackson. That's the football player guy.
Yeah.
He's basically like, yeah, and I said, suck my dick,
bitch. Yeah. You know, so like, you know.
Yeah. And then you have that, and the, you know, the blatant misogyny of talking to the dudes, and then you know, on the other hand, he's very
so it, yeah. So it still that part works still because of the context of when the film was made. But also too, like especially because there is a lot of misogyny in the film.
Oh yeah.
Catherine is kind of still like a beacon of independence, because she recognizes the double standard that goes on in life. Like, she's like, everyone likes to fuck. Everyone wants to fuck. You can fuck and no one gives a shit. I fuck and I'm a slut.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, you know, and that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, so.
I mean, it does go into that a bit. I do think that.
It's like, not great commentary, sure. But at least like pointing out the double standard that, you know, that is there. Like, you know, Sebastian gets to run around like, yeah, I tricked this one bitch into, you know, letting me eat her asshole. And then she's like, if she were ever to say shit, oh, what, you're a slut. You know, so.
Yep. And I mean, I do think that there is some leniency afforded, while it's not great, there's leniency afforded to this movie from the 90s. This is a time when everyone was going around saying, that's gay. That's gay. But at the same time, you know, I do think that it does have a problematic portrayal of gay people, especially because Josh Jackson is obviously not gay in real life. So, you know, it's not even portrayed by a real gay guy. And it does kind of treat it as like flippant. Like, yeah, whatever. We're homophobic, yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, well, no, it definitely is. Cause he's like, oh, how would your dad like to find out you're a fudge packer?
Yep. Yeah. And not only that, like, I think that the whole idea of, like, exposing the closetedness of this guy is pretty yucky in general. I mean, we know that Sebastian's an awful person, but it's still a yucky thing that happens in this movie. So, you know, I think the movie has a whole lot of problematic elements to it, especially from its time period. Misogyny is definitely at play. Like, it's kind of crazy too. You know, you have this, you know, that guy Greg, who is like, supposed to be like Reese Witherspoon's character's best friend, right? Like, they like talk like they're like, man, we've been friends for forever. And then he goes around behind her back and is just like, you know, she bought it. You know, it's
just like a gay guy.
Yeah, the whole thing is just kind of like, ugh. Like, all these people are awful. But, you know, I don't know. I guess you forgive it because this movie is about horrible people.
Here's the thing, though. So, speaking on that, this film is trashy.
Oh, sure.
But it knows it's trashy.
Oh, yeah.
And it plays into the trashy. So it's kind of excusable because it's not trashy just because, like, oh, it's trashy. This film is trashy because that's what it's trying to be. This film is an exploitative film, and it knows it's an exploitative film, you know.
Yeah,
so it goes part and parcel. So, like, you know, so I think some of those aspects are slightly forgivable because, again, like. They're not making fucking Lawrence of Arabia. They know they're making a trashy R-rated film for teens.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. They know that it's trashy. I think that's...
I mean, the source material is like 18th century trash. You know? It's like literally like, you know.
Yeah. Anything else that we didn't talk about? That you can think of? Because I've pretty much exhausted my feelings about this movie. So I don't have anything else, but if you have anything, bring it up.
What did you think of Sarah Michelle Gellar and her corset?
It's great. I love that scene where she's just like after Mrs. Caldwell has left with Selma Blair, she like has to unzip immediately, pull out the corset, and then, you know, she's standing in the hallway and she's like, "Oh, Sebastian, won't you come here? Yeah, it's great. I mean, I want to say that I wouldn't be corrupted by Sarah Michelle Gellar if I was in this scenario, but I can't say that for sure.
You would be. 18-year-old you would have been Ryan Reynolds.
You're probably right. You're probably right. Especially given the grinding lap dance that she provides. Yeah. I probably would have.
She could be giving him a hand job. You don't know.
We don't know. We don't see it.
Her hand's off screen. Yeah. So.
But as we talked about, you prefer Sarah Michelle Gellar blonde or brunette?
Brunette. This film, isn't it? I'm like you. I love Buffy too, man. Or you forgot the redhead because she's Daphne too.
True.
But no, brunette.
For me, it's blonde.
It's in this film. Her look in this film is her look that I will always identify with. Dark, you know, dark hair, you know, bosoms pushed up at all times. Being a bitch.
You like the dominatrix-esque element to it, huh?
Sure.
Bring it on.
No, that's a different movie with Reese Witherspoon.
Yeah. would you go with Catherine, Annette? And I'm not even going to put Selma Blair in there because that's just weird. The whole idea of her, like, she's 15 years old in this movie. Catherine or Annette?
Catherine.
Gotta go with she'll hurt you, but she'll hurt you good. We can even put Tara Reid in there. Tara Reid.
Which is also funny, too, because that also goes to like the whole misogyny thing. She literally has sex with Ryan Phillippe, and that's the only person she's had sex with, and she's on the internet. Sluts.
I hear.
You know, web page playing like slots.
All right, so
just think of like how that bandwidth was probably stretched on that web page alone.
Yeah, I bet
because it was, you know, playing that over and over again, like slots, like, you know, the computer would locked up and like, oh yeah, play too many audio clips at once.
Yeah, I remember my computer doing that where if it was getting too overloaded, it would start stuttering and it would be like, it would just do that for forever until I restarted. Yeah. All right, so on a scale of 0 to 10 cocaine crucifixes, which I've got rosary beads, I've got to find one of those myself.
Look at this 6. This film has not aged well at all, but it's a lot of fun. It's trash. If you like trashy films, and this is a film for you, especially films from the 90s, if you like that kind of chic. To compare when we did She's All That is a good film on its own merits and works out for what it does. It's very enjoyable. This film's enjoyable because of the trashy romp that it is. It's definitely something you kind of have to know that you'll like, probably, especially today if you're younger. If you haven't really been experienced with these films, it's kind of could be hard to get into. But I think it's a lot of fun. Still, despite all its problems, it's just a quick, breezy, stupid teen comedy drama from the 90s. I think everyone's really good in this film except Ryan Phillippe. Ryan Phillippe's probably the worst in here because he's overly melodramatic. Sarah Michelle Gellar is great. Reese Witherspoon is great. Selma Blair is great in what they do. This, again, it's kind of hard to summarize. Like, if you don't like really trashy, exploitive, like a teen drama, then there's not going to be a lot of value here for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you like exploitative shit, this is going to be up your alley. Because especially nowadays, I would say this is definitely, in today's world, like it's an exploitative film.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Would have probably been considered that back in the day. It is now. But it's a lot of fun. And it's like, to me, this is peak Sarah Michelle Gellar. She looks great. She's great in this film. Such a manipulative bitch. You hate everyone. Yeah, 6 out of 10. I think kind of, it is what it is. You're either going to like it or you're going to hate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would give this a 6 out of 10 as well. I didn't find myself as enamored with it as I thought I would. It didn't really, like, I don't know, capture my attention as much as I recall. I think that Sarah Michelle Gellar does a really good job. I think she's, you know, she has this interesting allure to her in this movie where she is both, she has, like, that innocence to her that you get from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but then at the same time, she's able to kind of, like, on a dot, flip that and, you know, switch over to the sultry Catherine that she's is most of the time in this movie. So it's really great, and it makes sense. I feel like she's really realistic as a character. You know, Ryan Phillippe is fine. I don't really believe his character. I don't really believe the whole plotting about him changing, because that doesn't really come out in this movie. I feel like on the dot, you know, like it just turns at one point where he's kind of the bastard, and then after that, for whatever reason, he changes. And the film doesn't really make that relevance known to the viewer. Like, where did that happen? When did that happen? Why did it happen? It's not really well documented in this movie. It's just we have to take it at face value that, yep, he's a changed person now because of Nat. And like I said, if Annette's that great, she should have her vagina glowing golden with the rays coming out of it in that final scene of her driving down the highway in her Jaguar. Because that's the only reason that anyone can think of.
Who granted that to her, by the way? Who was like, in his will, he said, he's 17 years old. He doesn't have a will.
Yeah, he didn't know he was going to die that day.
he pulled the Yusuke from Yu Hockey Show. He pushed the kid.
Yeah, I thought, honestly, that, like, later on they were going to reveal, like, nope, he's alive. He's okay.
Which, by the way, sorry to interrupt your end, but this is one point we did mention. What do you think of his death?
Yeah, it's goofy.
It's so shitty.
Yeah.
He should survive getting hit by that taxi at 25 miles an hour.
It's goofy, but...
I love you.
Dead. I know, it's like one of those things where you think he's going to come back like he faked his death just to fuck over Catherine, but... Yeah, I mean, I think the whole that brings up the whole idea of the issue of the plotting. The plotting is really messy. It's, like you said, it's very trashy. It's very soap opera-esque. And, you know, if you grew up in this time period, you probably love it, and that's fine. We've said a lot of bad things about Cruel Intentions, but it's also kind of a fun movie, too. And it's fine to like trashy movies at times, and if you like Cruel Intentions, you know what? No bad feelings, no hard feelings about it, because I can understand why.
I've literally suggested this film just on nostalgia alone.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen this probably film probably like 10 times. I haven't seen it in like probably 15 years or so.
Yeah.
And but like, you know, so again, it's like any probably enjoyment I get out of this film is still just based on nostalgia.
Yeah. Because I don't think anyone would argue that it's a particularly good movie. But it is fun, and it does have a big nostalgia trip to it, you know, from the music to the character, to, you know, to the actors that are in it. It everything about this screams nostalgia. So it's definitely understandable why people would like this movie, despite the fact that it's really not that good. And I think for whatever reason, it just gained a lot of traction at that time period when it released. And, you know, people like trashy cult films. I like really bad movies sometimes. So I totally understand why someone might like this movie. But just revisiting it and, you know, going off of gut instinct alone, it's not that great of a movie. Give it a 6. So what's our next foray down memory lane? At some point, we'll have to do Cruel Intentions 2 and 3. However, I'm definitely dreading that.
This has never happened.
Those things didn't happen. I don't know. I was thinking about what we could do. You know, because we're not really doing the Marvel movies anymore, right? We're not like trying to keep up with those.
We're too far behind to hop.
Just so many. There's just so many that came out. It's hard to keep up with them all. I was trying to think about what other things that we wanted to do. There is, you know, Bo is Afraid that just came out. I don't know if you're interested in checking that one out. That's from Ari Aster, who did Hereditary.
I, you know what? Somebody mentioned to me that not that long ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that just came out. I don't know, again, if it's widely available right now.
Oh, you don't want... An idiot. My sister's boyfriend mentioned it to me when I was telling him we had a podcast and how we did Hereditary.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, I was thinking that we could do that one.
We haven't done Midsommar yet.
Or you want to do that one first?
Holy shit, 179 minutes.
What, Bo is Afraid?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a rare song.
God damn.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could do Midsommar if that would make you feel better. If you, I mean, if you wanted to do that because you wanted to do it in like an order of Ari Aster's film releases, that's fine with me too.
Do you want to do, we'll do back-to-back weeks, we'll do Midsommar and then Bo is Afraid?
Yeah, that's fine. With Midsommar, do you want to do the regular theatrical or do you want to do the director's cut?
We'll do what we can find.
Yeah, because I mean, the regular one is about 2.5 hours long. The director's cut is about 3, I think. I think I've only seen the theatrical. I did not watch the director's cut.
I haven't seen Midsommar, but I've seen a bunch of clips from it, so I know it's Wicker Manny.
Yeah, it is Wicker Manny. Saw it a couple years ago. So it does have, you know, it has some affecting scenes in it again. I like Hereditary more, but I do think this is it's a pretty fun movie. I guess I shouldn't say fun.
You did say that during our Hereditary review.
What's that?
That you liked Hereditary.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do like Hereditary more than Midsommar. But you know what? Let's do it. Let's check it out.
Which my sister's boyfriend also laughed when I said, like, yeah, well, he's like, what'd you think of Hereditary? And he's like, it's like watching a family story. Oh, that was funny. But, yeah, you know, I'd be interested because Midsommar's definitely been a film I've wanted to watch, and, Hereditary was really good, so.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what you think of it.
I think it'll be a good stop before we start rolling into Red Hot 80 Action Month.
Yeah.
Hummer. Which, by the way, too, when at Walmart today, and I was looking through the DVD bin, see Cruel Intentions was in there. You know what was in that $5 DVD bin at large?
What's that?
Parasite.
Oh, really?
Yes, what I said is I was sifting through just hunks of DVDs of Parasite, and I was like, wow.
Yeah, really? Wow. Interesting.
That belongs.
Yeah. All right. Let's do Midsommar. Yeah. Then we gotta jump into Kaijun too.
Shit. Yeah. So we got. Okay. So let's do the math on the month. Because we are just. If you don't know, folks, Kaijun, we're doing a new thing. Did we bring that up before? Or no?
I think we said it once or twice that we were thinking about doing Kaijun.
We got actually. Shit. Are we only going to do 3 weeks? Because June's... I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, June 2nd would be the day that we would need to start Kaijun, I guess.
No, because if we didn't want... If we started on the 7th, because we record on Wednesdays, we'd get we would get 4 weeks out of it, because we'd get the 9th, 16th, 23rd, and 30th.
Okay, yeah, so that works.
If you want to do that. So we could do 3 straight weeks in... We can either do 3 back-to-back Ari Aster and then take a week off and then roll into Kaijun, or we can do, like, just keep rolling.
Yeah.
It's up to you. You're the pilot.
Yeah, we could probably do back-to-back weeks of Ari Aster and then Kaijun after. Have a week off in Kaijun. Sounds good. Yeah, so we'll do Midsommar next time. It'll probably be the theatrical cut, to be honest with you. But if we do end up finding the director's cut, because I don't have it. I don't have the director's cut or anything.
Was that not online anywhere?
I don't think it's streaming anywhere right now. Yeah. So we'll do that, though, and then we'll try to find Bo is Afraid.
Midsommar's on Hulu?
Is it on Hulu? Is it on, like, the, Showtime for Hulu, though? Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's for Showtime. Yep.
What the hell is up with that?
Yeah, it's annoying.
What the fuck are these guys? Hey, you gotta pay for the subscription. Okay. You gotta pay for this other subscription to get this.
Yeah, I know.
Fucking stupid.
Horrible setup for streaming services.
Same thing, too. Like, why is Cruel Intentions not on a fucking streaming service at this point? Who made
should be easy to get the rights.
No, who made that one? Because I'm trying to see who made the goddamn film.
They don't know.
Because at one point it was on HBO Max. I know that. It's not anymore.
It was by... I don't even see. I don't know.
Point is, should be on a streaming service at this point. Everyone's got one. Don't fucking use back catalog bullshit. You own the rights. Fucking digitize it and put it up.
Columbia owns the rights.
So fucking Paramount should be putting that shit up. Fucking stupid. Stupid. You own the rights. Put it up. Doesn't matter if nobody's gonna watch this shit. Put it up. Generate revenue, for God's sakes. Holy shit.
All right, so we're gonna be back next time with Midsommar.
Hope you tune in for that one. Thanks for listening to our episode on Cruel Intentions. Hope you enjoyed it. We are on pretty much any podcasting app that you can think of. Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or home based at anchor.fm, which is now Spotify. Subscribe to us. Leave us a nice review. We are on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for us in there, Blood and Black Rum Podcast. And we have an email address at bloodandblackrumpodcast@gmail.com. Write to us. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what you want to hear us cover. And we will take that into consideration. And we have a Patreon page that you can donate to. Patreon.com/BloodandBlackRumPodcast. You can send us money and we'll put it towards beer. Thanks a lot in advance for that. I hope you join us next time for our episode on Midsummer. And until then,
see you here.